This is Paul Green, chairman of the City Club of Chicago and WGN political analyst. Dick Durbin spoke at the City Club discussing all kinds of law enforcement issues, most of which dealt with incarceration, police community relations, and the fact that we have a serious drug problem that needs to be addressed.
I was just thinking when Tony said those nice words about an experience I had a little over a year ago. It was a naturalization ceremony down in Springfield. And a lady came up to me afterwards and she said, boy, I've been waiting to meet you a long time. You know? She said, I was your sister's roommate at St. John's School of Nursing back in the 60s. And your sister told me, watch out for my kid brother. He's going to get into politics and he's going to get elected. And she says, so I watched, and sure enough, you got elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, and then you got elected to the United States Senate, and now I finally get to meet you. And I just wanted to say hello and wish you the best. And I said, thank you so much, but I don't have a sister. She said, you are from Decatur. I said, no. She said, well, never mind. And thanks, Jay Daugherty. Thanks, Paul Green. And special thanks to Tony Preckwinkle. This is a serious topic that I'm going to address today, but it's one we need to face in the city of Chicago, Cook County, state of Illinois. And it deals with what we are going through right now when it comes to issues of justice, criminal justice and economic justice. Half a century ago, legalized segregation was dying in the Old South. After a bitter and bloody struggle over civil rights, America finally passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. Finally, the long debate over voting rights and access to housing and restaurants and schools led to this historic legislation. Then came August the 11th, 1965. 5 days after Lyndon Johnson signed this landmark legislation, an African-American man was arrested for drunk driving in Los Angeles. There was a roadside argument that escalated into a fight. That fight became a spark that lit a bonfire. What followed was 6 days of riots in Watts, 34 people dead, $40 million in property damage. Martin Luther King had been the nation's leader when it came to trying to finally close the book on our nation's divided past. But when Dr. King looked at the Watts riots, he was afraid he was looking at America's future. He knew that the conditions that fueled the Watts riots, poverty, unemployment, poor housing, failing schools, were not just limited to the South and Los Angeles. They existed in poor communities of color across the nation. So in January 1966, 50 years ago, Dr. King brought his ministry to Chicago to begin what he called the next phase of the civil rights movement. He said, this phase is about economics. He moved into a third-floor apartment in a rat and roach-infested building in North Lawndale. The door to the street was broken, the halls smelled of urine, and the heat didn't work. And it was from that squalid apartment at 1550 South Hamlin that he set out to end slums in Chicago and across America. 9 months later, after many confrontations, Dr. King left Chicago disillusioned. He went into seclusion to write his final book. He called it, Where Do We Go From Here, Community or Chaos? The question that troubled Dr. King 50 years ago haunts us today. When the video of Laquan McDonald was released, showing the son of a 15-year-old mother being shot 16 times in 13 seconds and falling dead on the pavement of South Pulaski Road, we could no longer avert our eyes from the reality of the challenge we face. Many of the same neighborhoods that Dr. King hoped to change, mostly on the South and West Side, still struggle. High poverty, unemployment, poor housing, troubled schools, high crime, high incarceration, and now flooded with guns. Last month, there were 280 shootings, 51 murders in Chicago. The deadliest January in 16 years. 47 of those 51 killings were with guns. The level of violence in Chicago is far higher than either New York or Los Angeles. We look to our criminal justice system to help keep our communities safe from violence. But our communities deserve a criminal justice system that not only keeps the peace, but is also worthy of America's ideals and our commitment to fairness. Before we talk about the substance of change, we need to acknowledge three things that have changed dramatically since the days of Dr. Martin Luther King and transform our national conversation about justice. The first, video cameras. Dash cams in patrol cars, body cams on police, cell phone cameras in probably everybody's pocket in the room. That's replaced anecdotal evidence and conflicting stories with hard reality. Laquan McDonald, shot, falling, shot 15 more times as he laid in the street. Eric Garner in New York, his dying cries of "I can't breathe" as police held him in a chokehold, recorded on a cell phone. His crime? Selling individual cigarettes. Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old unarmed boy, shot and killed in a Cleveland park by a police officer who opened fire 4 seconds after he got out of the car. All captured on video, in real time, with real pain. The second game changer, DNA testing. Let me tell you a story. In 1976, a terrible crime was committed. A little 9-year-old girl named Lisa Cabasa was raped and strangled to death in a Southside neighborhood. Police arrested two 17-year-old young men, both poor and black, Michael Evans and Paul Terry. Neither of them had a criminal record. They were convicted and sentenced to terms of 200 and 400 years. Years later, the man who prosecuted these young men had become a defense attorney. He revisited these convictions and fought to have a DNA test performed. The DNA test proved conclusively that Michael Evans and Paul Terry did not commit the crime. In 2003, they were both released after serving 25 years in prison. Nationwide, 337 people convicted of crimes have been exonerated by DNA evidence, 20 on death row. Illinois has 45 of those exonerations, more than any state except Texas. And special thanks to Northwestern University and the Illinois Innocence Project for their determined efforts in our state. DNA has forced us to face the scientific certainty that our criminal justice system failed too often in prosecuting even heinous crimes. Innocent people have been convicted, while the real criminals often are never found. The third game changer, social media. We don't have to wait for the evening news or the morning paper or the top of the hour. Information, right and wrong, shared with lightning speed, creating reactions and overreactions. Fights and feuds escalate over social media as easily as they used to escalate in the streets. So this is the context of our challenge as we inventory and assess our criminal justice system. Hard video evidence, DNA science, instant communication. What is our path forward here in Chicago? The Laquan McDonald video, horrific as it is, calls on the city and the Chicago Police Department to examine fundamental issues, including training, use of force, and bias. Mayor Emanuel has already instituted some changes meant to lessen the use of deadly force, including tasers to all patrol units. And I applaud the decision by the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, and the U.S. Department of Justice to conduct a thorough review of the Chicago Police Department. I joined Attorney General Lisa Madigan in calling for the Department of Justice investigation for two reasons. Number one, I think the Chicago Police Department will benefit from an impartial outside evaluation. And two, DOJ reviews of police departments in other cities after police-involved shootings have shown the right path to change for the police and the people and the neighborhoods they're charged to protect. Let me give you an example. 5 years ago, Seattle, Washington had its Laquan McDonald moment. A police officer shot and killed a 50-year-old man as he crossed the street carrying a block of wood and a small open pocket knife. The officer yelled at the man to drop the knife 3 times. Seconds later, he shot and killed him. What the officer didn't know was that the man was a Native American wood carver who made his meager living carving wood figures to sell to tourists. He didn't know the man was hard of hearing, with a history of substance abuse and mental struggles, but no history of violence. The Department of Justice investigated the Seattle Police Department, recommending changes in training, as well as reforms, to make them more accountable to the public. With strong backing from the Seattle Mayor, Ed Murray, They made changes that have dramatically reduced the use of force against mentally ill persons. Before the Department of Justice review, 40% of Seattle police encounters with mentally ill resulted in the use of force. 40%. After the review, 2%. Now let me be clear. I want to say this and say it with no equivocation. I believe the vast majority of police officers in Chicago and elsewhere are dedicated public servants who risk their lives every day to protect us. They are working in a city flooded with guns and gangs. They deserve our thanks, and they deserve our best efforts to make them even better professionals. I hope the mayor and the superintendent and the entire police department will receive the findings and recommendations of the Department of Justice with an open mind and work to implement them. There's another point we should understand. The reason that many Chicagoans are upset, the reason Black Lives Matter demonstrators shut down parts of the Magnificent Mile the day after Thanksgiving, isn't just because of the Laquan McDonald video. People are angry about the fact that we have, in fact, two separate systems of justice in America. One for people with money and connections, and a harsher system for poor people, especially people of color. There are several ways we can make our criminal justice system fairer and more effective. No serious discussion of crime in Chicago or America can start with any other topic than guns. We cannot allow ourselves to be numbed or resigned when it comes to the deadly impact and easy access of firearms. I went to the Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms Agency office a few months ago here in Chicago. They just completed a survey of the crime guns that were seized in the most dangerous neighborhoods in Chicago. 40% of those crime guns can be traced directly to gun shows in Northwest Indiana. All you need to do is produce an ID there, and you can fill up the trunk of your car with guns and ammo. A lady came to my town meeting in Washington this week from Chicago. She talked about this issue, and she said, "What can I do?" I said, "Ma'am, there's only one word, elections." And still, until we start replacing members of Congress who live in fear of the NRA, Congress is going to stand on the sidelines while this gun death epidemic continues. Second, the inequalities of our system of justice start as early as kindergarten. After the Columbine massacre, many school districts, including Chicago, instituted zero tolerance. They adopted get-tough disciplinary practices, steering too often kids out of school through suspension, expulsion, or police involvement, and into the criminal justice system. It's been called the school-to-prison pipeline. A schoolyard fight that used to warrant a visit to the principal's office can now lead to a trip to the booking station and a judge. Studies show that students of color are far more likely to be suspected, expelled, and arrested than their white peers for the same behavior. Such disparate treatment limits a child's future. 2012 Johns Hopkins University study found that just one suspension in the ninth grade reduced a student's chances of graduating high school from 75% to 50%. Another study by the U.S. Department of Justice found that a minute a child sets foot in the juvenile justice system, their chances of becoming an adult offender go up 50%, and their chances of getting into college or the military or a job plummet. 4 years ago, I chaired a Senate hearing on the school-to-prison pipeline, first congressional hearing on the subject. We heard case after case from all around the country of abuses where kids were yanked out of school and into the criminal justice system. There was a judge who testified there, an impressive fellow, from Clayton County, Georgia, Judge Stephen Teske. He saw exponential increases in the number of students coming into his courtroom for minor offenses. Judge Teske called together school and police officials and said there's got to be some better way to do this. They developed training to help school police officers defuse tense situations. Judge Teske talked about the difference this can make. In one instance, a high school student, a young woman, threw a chair in a classroom. The school police officer was called, but instead of handcuffing her, the school officer led her out of the room and sat down and talked with her. After 2 hours, the girl broke down and revealed that her mother's live-in boyfriend was raping her. The girl was taken into protective custody, the boyfriend arrested. Listening to that young man instead of arresting her didn't cost more money, it saved us money, and it gave her a chance. Clearly, violent students must be removed from the classroom, and genuinely criminal conduct should be punished, period. But criminalizing nonviolent, non-threatening behavior can have a devastating consequence. There are better alternatives. One of them in our state is a program called Redeploy Illinois. This program diverts at-risk youth to community treatment instead of incarceration. It costs about $100,000 a year to house a juvenile in our juvenile prison system. This program costs $5,520 a year for each juvenile. Last year, Redeploy saved Illinois $30 million and kept 500 kids out of the state's youth prison. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. Because our state doesn't have a budget, 23 counties have been forced to stop accepting kids and close their programs. We need to save Redeploy Illinois and bring it to Cook County. The third issue is sentencing reform. There are some people who should be in prison. I can't stress that enough, but there are many who shouldn't. In the 1980s war on drug, we saw an explosion in people imprisoned for nonviolent drug crimes. More than three decades later, the United States of America holds more prisoners by far than any other country in the world. We have 5% of the world's population, nearly 25% of the world's prisoners. A disproportionate number of people in America's jails and prisons are poor, African Americans, and Latinos. America locks up black people at a rate higher than South Africa at the height of apartheid. Young men of color are six times more likely to be incarcerated than white males. And one out of every three black men in America is predicted to go to jail or prison at some point in their lives. One in three. The over-incarceration of poor people of color is devastating to communities of color. Fathers, sons, brothers, uncles separated from their families, locked away in prisons for years and sometimes decades, often for nonviolent offenses. The primary breadwinners in many families are spending their peak earning years behind bars. Instead of contributing to their families and society, they're costing society. The price tag, at least $30,000 a year for each person incarcerated. One of the worst examples was a law that I voted for, and it was an overreaction to the discovery of crack cocaine. I was a member of the House, and they said to us, this is deadly and it's cheap, and if a woman takes it and is carrying a baby, that poor baby is going to have its health and life compromised. We did something over 25 years ago that sounded right at the moment but was terribly wrong. We said that we will put a sentence on crack cocaine offenders 100 times the level of sentences on powder cocaine. 100 times. The law was passed on the mistaken belief it would have that the crack was vastly more potent. This law was devastating to people of color. African Americans make up 30% of crack users, but accounted for more than 80% of those sentenced under those guidelines. 6 years ago, Congress voted unanimously to pass a bill which I authored called the Fair Sentencing Act. It marked the first significant step in reforming federal drug sentencing law since the war on drugs. The Fair Sentencing Act dramatically reduced the crack powder disparity and eliminated the 5-year minimum for simple possession of crack. I stood next to President Obama in the Oval Office when he signed it into law. I'm working now with two unusual, maybe surprising allies, Chuck Grassley of Iowa and John Cornyn of Texas. We're working together with Attorney General Loretta Lynch on a criminal justice reform bill which gives a sentencing judge more latitude in cases involving drug crimes where there are no guns, no kingpins, no violence. We want to take taxpayers' dollars wasted on over-incarceration and spend them on prevention and proven approaches to neighborhood safety. Being tough on crime doesn't mean simply voting reflexively for even harsher punishment, no matter the cost. Being tough on crime also means being tough on failed criminal justice policies. I want to tell you a story that illustrates why we need to be willing to reform harsh and inflexible sentencing laws. Alton Mills says that when he grew up in Chicago, there were only three things a young man could do in his neighborhood in the early 1990s: play sports, be a mechanic, or sell drugs. He chose sports as his ticket to a better life, but a bad knee injury ended his days as a promising high school football star. He tried to steer clear of gangs and drugs. He got a job. He lost his job. Then for 2 years, he carried crack and cocaine for drug dealers. The people above Alton Mills, the leaders in the cocaine ring, raked in thousands of dollars every week. They paid him $300. He was arrested twice for possession of a small amount of crack. Then the police arrested the entire crack cocaine ring. The high-rolling dealers Alton had worked for received light sentences because they decided to plead guilty and testify against him. The judge looked at Alton's two earlier arrests and said, "My hands are tied. The law says three strikes and you're out. I have no option but to sentence you to life in prison." Alton was 24 years old. He had never spent a day in jail in his life. And now he was going away for life. But Alton, in one respect, was very lucky. He never lost hope. His mom and dad never gave up on him. And then he found an angel. I'm not kidding. He found an incredible, dedicated lawyer, a public defender, named my angel Cody. She fought for Alton Mills. Last year, just before Christmas, President Obama commuted the remainder of Alton's sentence. After 22 years in federal prison, he was able to come home to his family. I'd like you to recognize Alton Mills and my angel Cody. Asked him what was different when you got out. He said, "These clothes that people are wearing. Skinny jeans and pants hanging way down there. And these cell phones." He said, "I looked at one for 2 hours before I could figure out what to do with it." So, welcome home. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act has strong bipartisan support. It isn't going to spare wrongdoers for paying for their crimes, but allows judges some discretion in those cases where smarter sentencing makes more sense than mandatory long-term sentences. And it ends the three strikes and you're out law. The fourth proposal is something we can do to rebuild trust in the community between the criminal justice system and the actual people who need to benefit from it. I recently asked a friend who defends people accused of white-collar crime in federal court whether in her 30 years she'd ever had a client who couldn't post bail. She said, "Never." It's a very different story if you're poor, especially if you're poor and a person of color. Do you know that only 7% of people in the Cook County Jail are actually there serving sentences for crime? The other 93% are waiting for trial. Many languish in jail, away from their families, jeopardizing their jobs because they don't have $500. Some cases, they don't have $50 to post bail. Judge Tim Evans, supervising judge of Cook County, Sheriff Tom Dart, President Tony Preckwinkle joined forces. With the support of the Arnold Foundation, they found a safe way to reduce Cook County jail populations and cut correction spending. Here's what they did. They established a matrix of risk factors to predict the likelihood of rearrest or flight. If a person committed a low-level crime and is likely to show up for trial, not likely to be rearrested again, they're eligible to be released on their own recognizance. In 2 years, this sensible strategy has led to a substantial reduction in the Cook County jail population, from over 10,000 to about 7,400 today. I understand that the program may be expanded to include other low-risk inmates. Fifth point, Sheriff Dart reminds us time and again that Cook County Jail is the largest gathering of persons with mental illness in America. He's been a leader in pointing out the need for counseling and care. Tom tells me that many inmates with mental health and addiction problems tell him that Cook County Jail is the first place they've ever been where anyone even cared about their struggle. They had to go to jail to get help. President Tony Preckwinkle has directed the jail staff to make sure that appropriate health service is available after people leave jail. Before a person is released from Cook County Jail, staff make sure that each person has health insurance if they're eligible for county care. She estimates they've enrolled over 10,000 people in the last 2 years, including many who now have an affordable choice for treatment for mental illness and addiction. Imagine what a difference that makes in their lives. And for the record, repealing Obamacare eliminates county care and the guarantee that we wrote into the law that every health insurance policy contained coverage for mental health counseling and addiction. I reached out to a lot of community leaders before I came up here today. You'll know many of their names right off the bat. Terry Peterson, Father Flager, Coach Wayne Gordon, Dr. Brazier, Reverend Tory Barrett. They told me a lot of things about their insights into the challenge we face here in Chicago. And they told me a top-down approach has some value. But to bring peace to our neighborhoods, we need also grassroots commitment, revitalizing block clubs, neighborhood organizations, and congregations to unify residents against guns, against crime, drugs, and poor schools at the grassroots. Now, I've just touched on a few of the major elements of criminal justice reform. Time and again, as I've talked to leaders around this community, they've all pointed to the state budget crisis. And I say to my friends here at the General Assembly, you know exactly what I'm saying. Whether it was cutbacks in daycare, cutbacks in counseling, cutbacks in treating the disabled, it's taken a toll in our city and across our state at exactly the wrong time. I called together the Black Caucus of the Chicago City Council for a Monday morning breakfast. I didn't know how many would show up. There are 17 of them. 12 actually showed up. The value of free bagels. I asked each of them to tell me a little bit about criminal justice reform from their perspective in their ward, and they each spoke for about a minute on criminal justice reform, and they quickly switched topics, every one of them, to jobs and poverty. They said if we want effective criminal justice, we have to work for economic justice. And if you want real criminal justice, you have to work for economic opportunity. Let me close by suggesting one way we can start. A couple weeks ago in Crane, Chicago Business, Sheriff Tom Dart wrote an op-ed. And he says, when I walk through the jail and analyze detainee criminal histories, it's increasingly clear that those jailed on nonviolent charges are predominantly good people who were born on the wrong side of the tracks. They made mistakes and are eager for second chances. Permanently shutting the revolving door between the streets and jails begins with offering fair opportunities for solid jobs or steady incomes. But many ex-offenders are caught in a kind of limbo. Polls show that Americans overwhelmingly believe that overly harsh war on drugs laws locked up too many people for too long. Yet many people are still reluctant to give an ex-offender a job. The SAFER Foundation has been working in Chicago for 44 years to partner well-trained ex-offenders with employers who are willing to take a risk and give somebody a second chance. Each year, over 30,000 inmates are released from Illinois prisons, and about 12,000 end up here in Chicago. SAFER has helped countless thousands build new lives. Craig Friedman knows the SAFER Foundation very well. Craig's the president of Friedman Seating Company, a family-owned business which I recently visited that had been in Chicago for 125 years, four generations. They make seats for minibuses and other vehicles. Craig has hired more than a dozen good workers through SAFER. Loriano Trevino is one of them. Loriano grew up on the south side of Chicago in a stable, middle-class family. He got involved with gangs at age 15 and then drugs. He spent 20 years in and out of the criminal justice system. A year and a half ago, he became the SAFER Foundation's Crossroads Adult Came to Their Center as part of a work release program. SAFER uses funds from the U.S. Department of Labor to train ex-offenders for high-demand jobs with good wages and promising careers. Friedman Seating Company makes seats for minibuses and other vehicles. 13 years ago, Craig Friedman hired Loriano, 13 months ago, Craig Friedman hired Loriano to work as a welder. He has been a model employee, learning new skills. He's also working on repairing his relationship with his family. When my office asked Craig Friedman if he'd come today, he hesitated, and he said, I have mixed feelings about coming. I'm not sure I want to tell too many people about the SAFER Foundation. I've gotten so many good workers from them, I kind of like to keep it a secret. Craig is here anyway, along with Loriano Trevino, and Victor Dixon, President and CEO of SAFER. Please join me in giving them a hand. You know what else you get if you hire an ex-offender? You get a federal tax credit of up to $2,400 for each ex-offender you hire. By the way, that same federal program, the Workforce Opportunity and Innovation Tax Credit, provides federal tax credits worth up to $1,200 for employers who hire low-income young people for summer jobs More on that in a minute. In closing, I want to issue a friendly challenge. Check out the Safer Foundation and other programs that help ex-offenders. And then consider very strongly becoming part of the solution by hiring an ex-offender at your business or your office. The best anti-poverty, anti-crime program is a job. And let me share one other idea. What if the business community in Greater Chicago teamed up with organized labor, the faith community, and scores of great organizations fighting for the future of this city and announced that 2016 is going to be the year of summer jobs? Most every one of us in this room got our start in the world of employment with a part-time or summer job that taught us what it meant to show up to work on time and put in a good day's work. Do you remember your first real paycheck? I do. Let's give kids who have never had that experience a chance to work this summer. And the federal tax credit will help the employers who pay for those new workers. Let me close by saying I've focused most of the speech on challenges involving the African-American community. But make no mistake, there are the same or similar challenges facing our Hispanic community. We need to make sure that as they live together in the city, they work together to find solutions. I told my staff I wanted to give a shout-out to some of my heroes and sheroes across this city and county, and the list got too long, so I apologize. So let me close with another quote from Dr. King. One of the great liabilities of history is that all too many people fail to remain awake through great periods of social change. Every society has its protectors of the status quo, its fraternities of the indifferent, who are notorious for sleeping through revolutions. But today, our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, and remain vigilant and face the challenge. This is one of those periods of great social change. This is an historic moment for our city. Let's stay awake, invest in proven approaches, and be open to new ideas. Thank you. Paul just told me I said closing four times.
Well, you get a pass because you work at the U.S. Senate. Okay. No, Jack? There you go. Wow. Boy, it's mushy. Try and get those forms out and look what happens. Okay, here we go. Rapid fire, real quick. Dave Lundy, sitting right in front, always firstest with the mostest. Aileron?
Aileron.
All right. The impasse in Springfield is ruining lives. If you could give one piece of advice to resolve the crisis, what would it be? Right up your alley.
At the risk of sounding partisan, I would say to the governor, it's time to govern and put at least on hold your obsession with ending labor unions.
Okay. Julia Ellis, where are you? All right, Julia, we have to upgrade the writing, okay? Are there actions we can take to achieve the mental health, that parity? Okay. Why don't you state your question briefly?
Are there actions that we can take to achieve mental health parity? Because having access to insurance is part one, but treatment times are short. Integration programs often don't exist, and job retraining is critical.
Something interesting is happening, and it's, in a way, very troubling. Heroin overdose deaths used to be the province of African Americans in the inner city. It is now everywhere. There is no town too small, no suburb too wealthy to avoid it. I have traveled all over the state with roundtables on heroin overdose deaths. It's everywhere. I went to Dixon, Illinois. In Dixon, Illinois, four kids died in the span of 10 days. In Dixon, population 20,000, Lee County. They were desperate. They heard about a police chief in Gloucester, Massachusetts, who came up with a new idea. His idea was, if you will present yourself to the police station or the sheriff's office and say, I'm an addict, I need help, we won't arrest you. We'll get you into treatment. What happened was 25 young people in Lee County came forward when they made that offer. To your point, where were they going to take them next? Well, it was an hour and a half drive to Rock Island and as long or longer to Chicago. So the availability of counseling and treatment for addiction is dramatically limited. The president announced this week a $1 billion investment, incentive investment in states that will pick up and try to increase the number of these facilities. Now, I say that at a time when our state legislators can tell you that the existing facilities are being underfunded in our state. It couldn't happen at a worse possible time. The reason there is a political opportunity here, and I'll be very blunt about it, when this was an inner city problem, it was discussed at one level. When it became everybody's problem, everybody's looking for a solution. So let's hope that when it comes to mental health counseling and addiction counseling, that this terrible tragedy across our nation will spark that kind of response.
You're on notice now. The next time you ask a question, okay. Very good question, by the way. Salim Al Nuruddin, Healthcare Consortium, can you speak to the policy of integrating special education with regular education and the use of drugs to treat behavior in schools? Hey, I didn't say it'd be a walk in the park.
I'm not really competent to answer that. We try to mainstream children, and any parent of a child with a challenge wants their kid to get into the regular classroom and start the path toward the right outcomes in their life as quickly as possible. Some students, young people, are so compromised by their disability that becomes hard to do, if not impossible. When it comes to the treatment with drugs, I don't know a thing about that, and I wouldn't profess to.
Seldom is the moderator stumped, as well most of you would agree that. But this is a stumper. Elsie C. Nabar, where are you, Elsie?
Here.
All right, there. I'm going to read your question exactly, and then you may have to explain it. Senator, that I got. The stalemate between Governor Rauner and Madigan is turning our state into a sinking ship, putting the fate of the people at doom. Is it about time for you to drop the gun? Okay, got it. All right.
Of course, both sides have to come together and in good faith resolve this. I said a comment earlier about the governor. I think his so-called transformation agenda or turnaround agenda includes some elements that I don't believe in, and I don't think the majority of legislators believe in. I hope that he will not make that one of the conditions for any kind of agreement. But you started off the right place. What is happening to this state I love and am honored to represent, is devastating. Devastating. Question about whether the Chicago Public Schools will open, whether or not they can have a bond offered that comes up with money to keep the school going for another year. That is not befitting a great city in a great state. We should have cooperative effort, and we should have some honesty. Some of these problems even predate the people sitting at the table here on pensions and other things that were decided at the state and city level. I worked there years ago, fresh out of law school, and the Pension Laws Study Commission used to come rolling through with a set of recommendations which very few, if any, people had read. And it be enacted, and off we'd go about the rest of our business. No real attention was paid to it. Now we're paying for it. Promises that we made we cannot afford to keep with the current level of revenue. That is the reality. And the sooner we face it and deal with it, the sooner this economy in our state will turn around and be in a stronger shape.
That's worth a round of applause, everybody. We're down to the final two questions, and as always, we leave the easy ones for the end. I know one person would be very interested in your answer to this question. Carly Hansen, a student at Northside Prep. Where are you, Carly? There you go, Carly. Oh, ho, daughter of Stella.
Granddaughter.
I was trying to make your grandma feel a little better. You know, work with me, will you? You'll like this. Easy question. One person is really interested in this, sitting at the head table. What do you suggest to solve the Chicago Public School budget crisis?
I don't think I'm expert enough to give you any detailed resolution of it. But there are several things that are pretty clear to me. First is the way we pay for teachers' pensions, is there something fundamentally flawed here? If the city of Chicago and its school district is responsible for teachers' pension funding on their own, and every other school district in the state gets state assistance for that purpose, something is not right. Pardon me? And we have a constitutional scholar here who says it's unconstitutional. And I would also say that as you look at the situation facing our state, and I know this will step on a few toes, but our school aid formula needs to be revisited. A friend of mine and a neighbor of mine in central Illinois, Andy Menar, a state senator, has come forward with a rewrite of the school aid formula to help poor school districts. As I may have mentioned to you at some time, I was born and raised in East St. Louis, Illinois. It's one of the two school districts the state currently controls. It is poor as can be, and they have no local economy to support their school district. And those kids, even with good state aid, struggle to get what most kids take for granted around our state. So I would say two things then. The pension system and the school aid formula are important. That doesn't resolve the current cash crisis by itself, but I think those are two things that need to be done.
Okay. This final answer based on this question really will only require a one-word answer. You know what's coming, don't you? This is from Suhail Khan. You ready? Everyone, get the cameras going. Hillary or Bernie?
Eight years ago, I had the painful task of approaching my colleague in the Senate and friend and the wife of a former classmate of mine at Georgetown, two people who had been very helpful to me in my political career, and to tell her that I was supporting my U.S. Senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. She took it well that I wouldn't be supporting her for president 8 years ago, and it was a kind of a difficult struggle for a while. I think we're okay now, and I'm supporting Hillary. But let me say a word. I think from a perspective of where she has served and what she has done, she has the qualifications to lead this nation. And when you think about a former Secretary of State and a person who's been that close to the top and served in the Senate for whatever that's worth, that I think she's ready to serve and to lead this country in along the values path that the president has established. A word about Bernie for a moment. And Bernie Sanders is not only my friend, I've served with him for years. What you hear on the stump from Bernie every single day, I have heard at lunch every week since he came to the Senate. And I don't say that mocking him at all, just to express the sincerity of his belief. He really, at his heart of hearts, believes about this whole issue of economic inequality. His presence in the race now, I know, is troubling many people in the Clinton camp, and how long he'll last, and so forth and so on. But he is moving the national debate to a topic that we should not avoid. We have got to deal with the reality that as American workers work harder, are more productive, create more profits for their company, it is not reflected in their wages. People are falling further and further behind. We can't get any traction with the Republicans on this issue in Congress. But I hope that at least those on the Democratic side will hear his message and make it part of our ultimate promise in this election. I think in order to maintain this democracy and be fair to a lot of working families, we owe it to him. Thanks, everybody. Great to be at City Council.